Oh, okay.
Okay, we're good.
Good morning. This is Friday, March 20th, and the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. Welcome. We are going to begin right away. Senator Hoffman is here. We don't have a quorum, but we can begin and move as far as we can, Senator. Do you have any amendments to this bill this morning?
Madam Chair, surprisingly so, I do not have an amendment for you.
All right. Very good. So present your bill and introduce us to your testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1530. It's the Patient Choice of Pharmacy Act of 2015. I realize our time is brief, and I know we have a full agenda, so I'm going to keep this simple and short. With me at the table today is Jeff Lindu, who is a pharmacist and the president-elect of Minnesota Pharmacy Association. And also, I have available, if you want to get deep in the weeds, Dr. Steven Sondelmeyer, who is from the University of Minnesota School of Pharmacy. Dr. Sondelmeyer is the foremost expert on pharmacy benefit economics and manages the university's pharmacy benefits plan, which consists of over 500,000 prescriptions filled each year. And he's just here to answer, available as a resource. So, Madam Chair, pharmacies are the primary place Minnesotans go for prescription medications, and pharmacists provide health information and services to help those manage the medications they seek for illness. What Senate File 1530 does is it would provide patients with the right to choose which pharmacy they have their prescription drugs filled. Increasingly, patients are being mandated by the benefits manager, PBM, to either have their prescriptions filled via email order or through a specialty drug pharmacy, as opposed to being able to choose to have their prescriptions filled at a local community pharmacy. Patients, Madam Chair, should be able to choose to have those specialty drug prescriptions filled locally with their community pharmacist as long as the pharmacy is willing to accept the same reimbursement and contract terms conditions as a PBM specialty pharmacy. And I will give you a personal example later. Pharmacists are not asking for additional payment, different plan rules, or any differential incentives. They want to play by the same rules. They're merely asking for the same terms and conditions so that they can have an option for their patients. Patient-centered care that they regularly see for their medication care needs. The relationship between a community pharmacist and a patient can have significant positive impact, CMS has even said that, on prescription medication adherence to the long-term health of the patient and better health outcomes when using their medications. Senate File 1530 guarantees that Minnesota citizens have a right to choose where they receive their medication care and have their prescriptions filled. Just like the following citizens have in, Madam Chair, in Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and many other states across the nation. With that, I turn it over to Mr. Lindu, and then we'll be happy to stand for questions. So, Madam Chair, Mr. Lindu.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Say your name into the microphone so that we get your voice on tape and each time you speak. So, thank you. And begin.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Jeff Lindu. I work for Thrifty White Pharmacies. We're a Minnesota-based pharmacy chain, and I'm also president-elect and representing the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. This bill is really an issue of patient choice and continuity of care. Some patients are fine with or maybe even prefer the mail-order benefit that is offered by their prescription drug plans. However, for some patients, they prefer or in some cases actually need for their health reasons to work with their local pharmacist to manage all of their medication needs. For those patients, maintaining that patient-pharmacist relationship is very significant to their long-term care outcomes and consequently to healthcare costs. When a patient requests that their local pharmacy fill all of their prescriptions rather than a mail order or specialty pharmacy, this bill prohibits their health plan or pharmacy benefit manager from excluding their pharmacy under these conditions if, as was stated before, the pharmacy accepts the same reimbursement and accepts all of the same contract terms, which might include service standards or requirements or quality metrics. All of our surrounding states have similar patient freedom of choice legislation South Dakota most recently passed theirs last year through public referendum. Our opposition will say that this bill will substantially increase costs to plan sponsors. Many studies have been done on this topic with varying results. Some of them do identify increased costs, others do not. South Dakota did a study prior to their referendum looking at states that had both patient choice legislation and those without, and they found varying situations, actually found some situations where it appeared to reduce costs. We submit that the jury is still out on this topic, and we have asked Senate Finance, where this bill will go, to look into, to carefully take some time and look into analyzing the potential costs for this legislation. We also suggest looking at the potential cost savings through better health outcomes, as well as improved quality of life through continuity of care with the local pharmacist. And with that, I'll ask if there are any questions.
Yes, Mr. Lindu, it is, correct?
Yes.
Can you, I understand it's a simple concept that you're presenting to us, and it is appealing because it's allows patient choice. If I'm trying to understand how this would work because I've never used the system in this way. Well, are you saying to me that a benefit manager can require me to purchase my medications by mail? And therefore, because I'm not going to my pharmacy where my pharmacist is, I don't have that conversation or that consult or that chance to sort of talk a little bit with the pharmacist about what I'm taking or what I might buy over the counter that would interact with that or the very the kind of conversations I have when I go into the pharmacy. And if I'm purchasing my product someplace else and I still go into a pharmacy where there's a pharmacist and have that conversation, that pharmacy doesn't have a way of capturing the costs of your consultation with me. This bill allows me to continue to have that if that's my choice. And you're saying that these pharmacies will accept the same reimbursement and standard systems, which is why I'm wondering what would drive increased costs if you're accepting the same payment. So can you help me understand that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I struggle with the same question. Again, the pharmacy is going to be accepting the same contract terms, the same contract conditions. We're not asking for our team to have four outs. We're not asking to allow a higher cost provider into a network. It's simply asking the pharmacy benefit manager or the health plan, whoever's managing the pharmacy benefit, to allow the pharmacy to consider, and if they choose to, accept those contract terms and allow that your local pharmacy to provide the same benefit that you would get through the mail.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Lindu hits it right on the nail. It's funny, in Commerce, this passed out without opposition from the Commerce Department. Senator Gazelka and Senator Metzen were on the same plane saying, well, I don't know how this is going to raise costs, and they kept going to it, and so they're under the same assumptions that we are, because if you're accepting the same terms, you're doing it. But the one thing that it does is you're hitting it right on as well, is you're able to go and talk to your pharmacist who knows you, knows your community, knows your family, knows what's going on in your life, and can have a one-on-one, person-to-person, patient-centered conversation. I agree with you. For me, I have to drive 40 miles because when my daughter has a wound, she's got, you know, when she has a needs some certain wound bandages, and I can't get them in Champlin. I have to drive to St. Louis Park to get 10, they'll only want me to have 10, and that's the specialty place where they could, if our system allowed it, I could pick them up in Champlin. But no, I have to drive to St. Louis Park and from Champlin and back just to get 10 bandages. So even though this isn't about me personally, but that's a prime example of what's happening right even in the Twin Cities. I love this bill because of the fact it allows me to then say, if you're willing to accept those same prices and terms and conditions, then why can't we have patient-centered care? And what do we know about patient-centered care, which is coordinated and collaborative, is your outcomes are better. CMS even said your outcomes are better because of that.
Thank you. Is there anyone at the table? Would you like to?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Say your name.
My name is Stephen W. Schottelmeyer. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, and I've studied this pharmaceutical market for 40 years. At all levels, I've been an expert in legal proceedings. I've been an expert serving to advise employers. I've worked with a few small employers in Detroit by the name of General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. I work with the university's own benefit. And my experience over the year in these various proceedings is that a lot of what we assume to be true and common, such as preferred networks are going to get lower rates, aren't always true. In fact, I've seen that often the opposite occurs. There are preferred networks of pharmacies that a given managed care organization might contract with, and they actually pay the preferred network more than they would pay the retail pharmacies that are asking to have access to those same patients. And the pharmacies are willing to take the low rate they're currently getting compared to those larger, more higher paid preferred networks. And the reason they can get these higher rates is we're talking about large chains often who say, look, we're not going to serve your patients at all unless you give us a 5% premium compared to the other pharmacies in your membership. Also, we assume that mail order is always cheaper, and I've seen numerous times that mail order actually charges patients more than what the retail pharmacy would for the same prescription. So I implore you to not accept the common assumptions. This pharmaceutical marketplace has transactions and pricing and behaviors hidden behind the scenes that you don't see, and you can't simply take at face value that preferred means a lower cost. It, in fact, means higher cost in many cases, and I think it would, if anything, lead to a higher cost rather than a lower cost if you don't allow patients choice.
Thank you, Mr. Sondermeyer. We've had other bills in front of the committee that are related to reimbursing rates for physicians and systems. It's the same in the healthcare system where you have a manager of the benefit sets or the manager of the pricing to the physicians or to the dentists or to the pharmacists, and how they negotiate differential rates. And is the principle the same in this, that for the preferred you're talking about, are large systems that have large controls over the market, and because of that volume of market, they have power in negotiations that a smaller, independent system does not have, or a smaller business doesn't have if they're singular in their negotiating rates?
Yes. I'll try to decompose your question because there are several parts to that. Often the preferred networks are with large chains of pharmacies, and those large chains of pharmacies do have more power, but it's more power in telling the managed care group, I want a higher price rather than a lower price. So it works in the opposite direction of what we might think.
It works in the opposite direction in terms of driving down costs, but it works in the same direction in the sense that they have more power to negotiate their rates.
Right, and they get higher rates.
And they get higher rates because of that. And that's what happens in all of the managed systems of healthcare. When the system itself gets bigger and they have more power, then they are better at negotiating the rates with the insurance companies than a small solo practice or a small or for insurance products for an individual buying on the market or a small business buying on the market. So it's that same concept that they negotiate a higher rate than the small independent, in this case, the small independent pharmacy.
It is. That's exactly right. And there's a second factor, though, in pharmaceuticals that I don't think is present in quite the same way in physician services, hospitals. It may be, but not quite the same. The managed care organization will negotiate with pharmacies to pay them one rate, and they will negotiate with an employer to charge the employer another rate. And those rates are different. And typically, the managed care organization will make a markup on what they've agreed to pay the pharmacies. And so they may their contract to the employer may look like the employer is paying the same rate for every pharmacy, but the actual amount that the pharmacies in from that managed care are paid may differ, and some get paid more and some less. And it strikes me every time I find this, and I found this in many data sets, it strikes me, why are the large preferred networks getting paid more than the real retail pharmacies at the corner drugstore? It just doesn't make sense, except for the differential power for the large chains saying, we're big enough, you have to pay us a little more. Mm-hmm. So preferred doesn't always mean lower price to the customer or the employer.
Are there any further questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We haven't got a quorum here, do we?
Well, there should be three across the hall.
Just hold just a minute. People have checked in, I guess. So we do have a quorum. So I would like to invite Mark. Any other questions for this panel? So are there others who would like to testify? Do we have a list? We have Bentley Graves, Director of Health and Transportation Policy, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Please say your name into the microphone and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bentley Graves. As you said, I'm from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I appreciate the opportunity to speak this morning. I will certainly keep this brief. I know that you have a long agenda. At the Chamber, one of the things that we approach the healthcare policy questions with is an eye towards cost. And this is exactly what we've done with this issue as well. Initially, I had a lot of the same questions that have been discussed back and forth here about isn't this a good thing that any provider can agree to the terms and therefore increase access or make it easier for the consumer? But in looking at this a little more deeply, I learned that this is something that CMS looked at doing through the Part D program just a year ago. And in the midst of that, I received fairly comprehensive comment from the Federal Trade Commission opposing move in that direction. And I understand that a copy of this letter didn't make it into your packets, and I apologize for that, but it is hopefully something we can follow up with you on. And I just wanted to cite just a couple pieces of this that I think get at why it is that there is kind of a cost question associated with the move to any willing pharmacy or freedom of choice. This letter from the FTC to CMS urging them not to adopt an any willing provider approach to the Part D program, the prescription drug program, says in part, the proposed any willing pharmacy provisions threaten the effectiveness of selective contracting with pharmacies as a tool for lowering costs. Requiring prescription drug plans to contract with any willing pharmacy would reduce the ability of plans to obtain price discounts based on the prospect of increased patient volume and thus impair the ability of prescription drug plans to negotiate the best prices with pharmacies. It also says that any willing provider and freedom of choice laws can make it more difficult for health insurers, plans, or pharmacy benefit managers to negotiate discounts from providers, resulting in higher costs. If plans cannot give providers any assurance of favorable treatment or greater volume in exchange for lower prices, then the incentive for providers to bid aggressively for the plan's business by offering better rates is undermined. It says then that any willing provider and freedom of choice provisions can therefore undermine the ability of plans to reduce costs, and this is likely to result in higher negotiated prices, ultimately harming consumers. And finally, these restrictions on competition may result in insurance companies paying higher fees to providers, which generally lead to higher premiums and may increase the number of people without coverage. And those, Madam Chair, underscore our concerns about a move in this direction. It is something, like I said, that has been looked at in a number of states, has been looked at the federal level. CMS decided not to move in this direction for those very reasons. And I just want to point out, too, there was some discussion about other states that have done this. As part of this letter as well, FTC did highlight the fact that in several studies, three of which are highlighted here, looking at states with these laws in place, they have found that they do have higher costs, both prescription drug costs and per capita spending on prescription drugs. So those are the concerns that we come to this conversation with. I have had great conversations with Mr. Lindu in particular about this, and I certainly understand the rationale for wanting to move in this direction. But as an organization that represents employers that provide insurance for the majority of Minnesotans, we do look at all these things with an eye towards cost, and those are some of the concerns that we have.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Graves. Is David Dieterix with us? He's from Express Scripts. Followed by David Root from Prime Therapeutics, if he would come forward at this time as well.
How are you, Madam Chairman? If it's all right with you, we've sort of switched the order. My name's David Root with Prime Therapeutics.
That'd be fine.
He's
welcome.
Addressing the call. Thank you very much. David Root, representing Prime Therapeutics. We're a pharmacy benefit manager that's headquartered here in the Minneapolis area, and we are the PBM for Blue Cross Blue Shield in Minnesota. In the interest of time, I'd like to focus just on a couple of items. We have heard this morning that all this bill does is allow pharmacies to compete on the same terms and conditions. In point of fact, that's half of what this bill does. Same terms and conditions on their own would be a completely separate topic. However, this section has Section 1, Sub 3, that prohibits a plan from institutionalizing any cost-sharing mechanisms. The prohibition on the cost-sharing mechanisms is actually prohibits us from sharing in the savings with the consumers. And to give you an example of what that looks like, the truth of the matter is that mail pharmacies have figured out a way to deliver the drugs at a cheaper, less overhead expense. That's a fact. We're not going to talk. We don't even have to talk about consultations. We have pharmacists, those types of things. But let's just exclude that for a moment and just focus on this measure. We are able to get the drugs to consumers at a cheaper price because we're able to consolidate our overhead as a mail order pharmacy. This language would prohibit that. So what that means for the consumer is typically a plan will work with us, and when they get their drugs at a mail order facility, they'll get 3 months' supply with a 2-month copay. So same terms and conditions, if sub 3 is not in there and it is straight same terms and conditions, that would mean that the pharmacies would have to agree to give a patient 3 months of a drug and only collect 2 copays. They're not going to agree to that. They can't agree to that. Those economics don't work out for them. So in point of fact, this bill is much more than just same terms and conditions because it eliminates one of the things that we do that provides the consumer access to that cost share, and it also provides the plan access to cost share. So there's two groups that get to share in that savings. The second sort of difficulty with this measure, and I think it's very important, is that, and it wasn't really addressed, this language deals with both aspects of pharmacy. It deals with, for lack of a better phrase, regular pharmacy and also specialty pharmacy. Now, in specialty pharmacy, you have specific clinical issues taking place here. Typically, among them, the largest among them is that there are drugs that the FDA approves now prior to the drug completing its full spectrum trial. Typically, these are drugs that have initially been found to be very helpful, very fruitful, and it would be considered unethical to keep them from the population that they would serve. But the FDA wants to continue the manufacture, wants to have the manufacturer continuing to study the product to make sure that there are no long-term side effects that were that they didn't know about. So when they put those programs together, the FDA will give the drug manufacturer approval, provided they have a limited distribution network. And that so then the drug manufacturer will come to a pharmacy benefit manager that services, in Prime's case, we service 35 million citizens across the country, and they'll say, we're going to set this up, you're going to be our exclusive provider for this product, here are all the forms and clinical information that you have to fill out every time you work with a provider who dispenses this product with a patient. And then we have to submit that information on a regular basis and partner with the manufacturer as they work through the rest of the FDA approval process for that drug. Those drugs are unavailable to a pharmacist. The patient isn't going to know that. So your patient is going to get a prescription. The patient's going under this legislation, the patient would go to the pharmacist and the pharmacist would say, I can't fill that drug. So now you've created a delay. Instead of the patient doing what the plan requires them to do, which is go to the mail order facility, the specialty pharmacy, to get the product, to work with the pharmacist at the specialty pharmacy to understand the nature of the drug, how it's injected or in put into their body in whatever capacity. The other issue around specialty drugs is simply the fact that you have a number of these drugs that have severe time limits on their ability to be shelved. Typically, a lot of these specialty drugs are injectables or other types of things that have very strict time limits and very strict requirements around housing those products. They have very tight sell-by dates, if you will. A regular pharmacy who's not equipped for that isn't going to be able to stock that product. The problem with this legislation as it relates to specialty pharmacy is those specialty products are very, very expensive, sometimes $10,000 or more a treatment, sometimes $1,000 or more a pill. The pharmacies are the incentive for them to try to say that they can dispense those products and attempt to dispense those products, whether they possess the expertise or not, is almost overwhelming, because then they would be entitled to that reimbursement. However, they are not necessarily going to be experts in the disease or experts in the administration of the product or know anything that the manufacturer may require with respect to the drug and the patient. We, on the other hand, that is what our pharmacies do, our pharmacists do in the specialty space. And I would also add, I mean, again, there are other things that we can talk about with respect to consultation. Our specialty pharmacies and our mail order facilities provide our members, all of our members who are members in Minnesota and across the country, to have clear and concise access with actual pharmacists to discuss anything that they wish at any time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So the notion that the only access point to a pharmacist is a community pharmacy is slightly askew.
Okay, thank you. We're running close to the end of the time for this bill, so I would ask the rest of the testifiers to add to the conversation and not repeat points that have been made so far. So we're going to move now to Mr. Diedrichs. Mr. Diedrichs, and then Catherine Kimmett, would you please come forward and be prepared as well to add to the conversation but not repeat?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dave Diedrichs with Express Scripts. We, too, are a pharmacy benefits manager, not headquartered in Minnesota like Prime, but headquartered in St. Louis, Missouri, with a large facility in Bloomington, Minnesota. On the topic of any willing pharmacy, there are 69,000 pharmacies in this country, actually a little north of that number. And just to give you an idea about how many that is, if you were to take all of the McDonald's in this country and all of the Starbucks in this country, and then add that number together and triple it, you would still have more pharmacies in this country than you do that number of McDonald's and Starbucks. As a company, Express Scripts has contracts with over 65,000 of those 69,000 pharmacies. And we do that for several reasons. Number one, CMS has geo access requirements, meaning that every beneficiary needs to be in X number of miles or within X number of miles of a pharmacy where they can get their prescription drugs. We also do that to satisfy client standards for geo access as well. So we need to have the small, rural, independent pharmacies in our network. In fact, the proponents of this legislation, the Independent Pharmacy Cooperative, most of them are already in our network because we have to have them in our network. The pharmacies that aren't in our network are not in our network for good reasons. And I'll give you two examples. Number one, oversaturation. Is particularly in urban and suburban areas. In my hometown, there is a particular intersection that three of the four corners of the street have pharmacies. And the fourth corner doesn't have a pharmacy, but two blocks down, there's a Cub Foods that has a pharmacy within it. There is not necessarily a reason for us to have all four of those pharmacies in our network. There is already a sufficient supply in the area. We also don't want to contract mandatorily with certain pharmacies because they have problems with fraud, waste, and abuse. Under this legislation, if they were willing to accept the same terms and conditions as other pharmacies in our network, we would have no choice but to have them enter our network, and we don't want that to happen all the time. Sometimes our clients choose to have smaller networks instead of having all 65,000 if, like, you're a nationwide employer. You want to have a smaller network because you have a smaller workforce. So sometimes you have a network of, let's say, 10,000 pharmacies, and in return you get a smaller administration fee, but you're giving the pharmacies access to greater foot traffic. So it's a win-win scenario. Last year, Express Scripts adjudicated over 1.2 billion prescription transactions, and over 90% of those occurred in retail in independent pharmacies. And the reason that our mail pharmacies didn't have a greater market penetration is simply because most prescriptions can't be filled at mail. Most prescriptions are for 10 to 30-day supplies of drugs, and therefore we need to have our beneficiaries and our clients have access to pharmacies where they can get those prescriptions filled. Mail order pharmacy is specifically for chronic conditions or maintenance drugs, which you're going to be on for a long period of time. David already talked about how it's more affordable. I'm just going to also tell you it's safer to use mail. A good retail or independent pharmacy, according to the National Association of Community Pharmacy, dispenses at a 99% accuracy rate. That means one out of every 100 prescriptions is the wrong dosage, the wrong drug, or the wrong amount. Our mail order pharmacy, because of the built-in redundancies and safety checks that we've instituted, dispenses at a 99.999999% accuracy rate, meaning we only make one error per 1 million transactions, and that's usually on a label, and we have an ink problem so that the lasers can't scan the label properly. As far as any willing specialty pharmacy, again, I'll skip over this because David touched on it earlier, Madam Chair. This is more than just a cost control measure. It's also about quality. Our specialty pharmacies in our network that our clients design and our clients choose are staffed with doctors, pharmacists, and nurses that are disease state experts, whether it's rheumatoid arthritis, hemophilia, cancer, or some other debilitating disease. We actually have specialists in these disease states that work with the patients on an ongoing basis. David mentioned about the exclusive distribution requirements by drug manufacturers. I also mentioned that the Food and Drug Administration also has certain REMS programs in place that require exclusive distribution amongst pharmacies. And finally, and I'll close with this, Madam Chair, if a pharmacy really wants to get into our network, all they have to do is fill out an application. For that, I'll
Thank you very much, Mr. Diedrichs, correct?
Yes.
I just would draw your attention to one section in the bill. You're talking about the issue of fraud. On line 1.21, the provider network has to provide pharmacy services that meet state and federal laws and regulations. So you have any issues about fraud can be resolved by that statement in the bill. Ms. Kimmett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to do this in 60 seconds. My name is Catherine Kimmett, and I'm here. She's timing me. On behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the Council opposes Senate File 1530. This bill forces health plans to contract with any willing provider and eliminates the important cost-saving tool that health plans use to hold down the cost of drugs. Even the proponents today acknowledge that this bill may result in increased costs to consumers. I think the public policy issue for you to consider is this. What kind of competition for the consumer, that is, what kind of competition is best for the consumer and most likely to result from the presence or absence of any willing provider laws? Imposing an any willing provider law will increase healthcare costs due to the loss of volume-based discounts, hinder the ability to efficiently and effectively manage the network and quality of care delivered, and add unnecessary complexity and administrative costs because health plans will be required to contract with many more pharmacies whether they are needed in the network or not. For all of these reasons, we urge the committee to reject Senate File 1530, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
And thank you for your commitment to your time frame. I just would say that we had a testifier last week come up and say, I can say what I'm going to say in 36 minutes. In 36 seconds, excuse me. It was 36 minutes. No, it wasn't. That's an exaggeration, but it was more than 5 minutes after a commitment to 36 seconds. We had one of our aides just put the timer on, and so people lose track of how much time they're taking. All right, thank you very much. Is there anyone else whose name I have not called that wishes to testify on this? All right, then we'll close the public section of this and bring it into the committee for questions. Senator Hoffman, this conversation about any willing provider often comes up in relationship to all of the health care provisions, you know, and it is the struggle between contracting with a large organization to manage the cost of health care. And one of the ways they do that is to determine who and the terms and conditions under which they contract. And we don't typically engage in redefining those terms in exchange for their managing the resources that we give them. So this issue has not only come up in relationship to pharmacies, but also to any willing provider of just any healthcare service. So it is a difficult question. It's not as simple as shouldn't people be able to have the choice of who they want services from. That's why I always find this conversation about irritation about the Affordable Care Act is being about eliminating or restricting the choices that people have in their health care options, because the current system that we have under managing care costs this way is controlling and limiting access to who someone would want as a provider. I would really like to have the proponents of this have a chance to respond to some of the assertions here. If we can do that within a few minutes, the ones in particular are the issues related to specialty drugs, the issues relating to the specialty drugs, how to manage the unique requirements that around specialty drugs that limit who can have those drugs and distribute those, which would restrict some pharmacies from being able to have them. That one in particular I was interested in, and the suggestion that the expertise doesn't exist at the local pharmacy level. Those two in particular. I don't know if there are others that people had questions about.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have, I have 3 pages of testimony that I was ready to read, but since, I don't want to get that, I will highlight a couple of points after the good doctor and Mr. Lindu respond to specifically the unique requirements in the specialty drugs, because the expertise piece, I'm going to get going on what we call the medical. It's part of the whole discussion of medical home and what we're finding. If Joe Nekonambe and the Mille Lacs band can figure out how to coordinate and collaborate and have choice for every member and get it to a system that works, I think we should have that same conversation. So that's a deeper conversation, which we will have, and I'm looking forward to that. But let's talk about specialty drugs, the unique requirements and the limitations, or so to speak.
And then the other thing, I was looking at my notes just to add to it. There was this the issue of the unique character of the cost sharing and other conditions that allows the cost savings to be shared with the clients so that a copay is relieved in a 3-month period one time. So I think that the testifier was talking about how that would be a condition that they would expect exist in this plan as well in order for it to truly be a similar cost sharing process.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have some, I have some quotes from the same CMS study that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services put out at the same time that I can add in addition to that. But let's start with Mr. Lindu and then Doc over here, and we'll go from there.
Thank you. And I'm sorry about our time, but if you can really focus clearly on answering the question.
Madam Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. Again, my name is Jeff Lindu. Regarding the cost-sharing issue, Mr. Root said that a community pharmacy can't accept that. The bill really does mandate that if a pharmacy accepts the contract terms, that the pharmacy must accept all of the contract terms and the cost sharing applied to either situation, whether it's a mail order or specialty or a community pharmacy in that network, it must be the same. I think I will acknowledge that there may well be times where a community pharmacy would look at a contract and simply say, I can't accept those terms. That's part of our free market system. This bill simply says that they have the opportunity to consider the contract.
Okay, so we want to make sure the language says that in relationship to this cost sharing, that because I think what they're trying to do is to not impose a cost sharing restriction on these independent pharmacies, that they aren't applying to their other providers of the service. So you said that you would, that this bill intends to have the same terms and conditions even on cost sharing, and I just want to make sure that if we move forward with that, that it does say that in response to that concern that was expressed. And then the other is the specialty drugs.
Madam Chair, if I could comment on that first issue of the cost sharing. The University of Minnesota does use Prime Therapeutics as our PBM, and we're very happy with them overall. I will tell you, in our network, we have retail pharmacies that accept 90-day prescriptions for two copays, just like we heard someone say that they wouldn't be able to. In fact, they do that routinely within our network, and we work with Prime Therapeutics, and they administer that. So I encourage their lobbyists to talk with the operations people at Prime Therapeutics and find out what they actually do. I would also comment that we offer mail order to our members, but we don't require it, and only about 3 to 4% use it. But we don't encourage or promote mail order to our members because we've found in many cases the mail order prescription costs more than the same prescription would have cost at retail. We tell Prime Therapeutics every time we meet with them, if you can show us that you can routinely have a lower cost at mail order than what the retail prescription would be, we would promote mail order more. They have not been able to show us that. The final point I would make is we have discovered within the database and how pharmacies are paid that one or two large chains get paid more than the retail pharmacies for the same prescriptions in the University of Minnesota plan. We did not ask for that to be the case. We did not ask for that preferred network. We encourage it because they help broaden the number of pharmacies our patients have access to. And we've asked Prime Therapeutics to negotiate with those large chains and get their rate down to the same rate that the smaller pharmacies are paid in the Minnesota market. And they say they haven't been able to leverage that large chain to accept a lower rate.
And the specialty drugs?
Especially, I would say we train pharmacists at the University of Minnesota. We're the number 3 rated program in the nation for training pharmacists, number 3 out of 130 pharmacy schools. We're well respected. Every one of our graduates is prepared to and can counsel patients on these specialty medications. There was a bit of misdirection also on the specialty issues. In fact, Prime Therapeutics and Express Scripts pharmacies can't get all of these specialty meds either. They're often limited. The specialty meds are often limited to 4 or 5 pharmacies nationwide, and it doesn't include either Prime Therapeutics Specialty Pharmacy or Express Scripts. So they have to send patients to other places too, not because of different expertise, but so the manufacturer can maintain a registry of patients and keep track of what's happening with those patients for safety reasons, because of FDA and manufacturer reasons, not because the pharmacists aren't trained appropriately, not because it requires a different level of follow-up, but it's because FDA and the manufacturer want to have a certain level of access. So Prime Therapeutics and Express Scripts, specialty pharmacies, don't have access to all of the meds either,
retail pharmacies. So how does that impact? So there's a there was a conversation about a delay, that there is a delay. So we're talking about a call and a discovery that you have to go someplace else, or what time of a delay is this for access to the specialty drug?
It's not a substantial delay. If a member in our network gets one of those prescriptions, we actually use Fairview Hospital Specialty Pharmacy rather than Prime Therapeutics Specialty Pharmacy, and there's no delay. And the same delay would occur if they had a prescription for a specialty med that Prime Therapeutics can't dispense. There would be a delay having to refer it to that pharmacy in New Jersey or Pennsylvania or Florida, wherever it is. So the same kind of delay occurs with their own specialty pharmacy. So they kind of implied that they don't have any limitations, but in fact they have the same limitations.
Thank you very much. I'm going to have to move the bill forward at this time. Senator Hoffman, you're on the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move Senate File 1530 to pass and to be moved. I believe it goes to Finance, and I don't know why, but that's what
correct.
I have. Is that correct, Chelsea? Thank you.
As amendment?
No amendments.
Okay. No amendments.
I promise you that.
All right. So on the motion to move 1530 be approved and moved to Finance. Any further discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Thank you very much. We have quite a good crowd here now. Just for those of you in the audience, I know you already know this. There's lots of comings and goings because we're on first deadline, and so we have bills being heard all over the place. Members have to come and go. But while we have a pretty good crowd here, I wanted to turn the microphone over to Senator Eaton in relationship to her bill that's going to be heard next week.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On Monday, we will hear the Compassionate Care Act, and it will be a hearing to start the conversation. It will be the beginning. This summer, we will do hearings around the state and continue the conversation so that we can hear how everybody in the state feels about it and to get the educated actual facts out there on how well this is working in other states. So I do thank the chair and the committee for the indulgence in hearing the bill. I have people flying in from Oregon, or I would move it outside the deadlines. So I do appreciate it very much, Madam Chair.
Okay. Then thank you. I just wanted the committee to know, and I want the public to know, that the goal is to allow for this expertise to come and present on the content of the bill, but that it is really not, we are not going to move the bill. We're going to lay it on the table, move out into the communities to have further conversations, and then bring it back in for an actual hearing on the bill probably next year.
Next year, yes.
So everybody clear about that? We're going to restrict that to the presentation of the bill this next week and not an actual community debate. Okay? Thank you. We're going to have more hearings throughout the state before we bring it back in for pros and cons of the community on the bill. Yes, Senator.
Madam Chair, so
Senator Benson.
We're just going to hear one side?
We're going to hear the presentation of the bill. And then we're going to move out into the community and allow a community conversation to occur there.
So, Madam Chair, experts will be brought in on both sides?
No, just the presentation of the bill itself. Do you have an expert that you'd like to bring in?
Well, I didn't know we were restricting public comment until this morning. So will it just be Senator Eaton presenting the components of the bill?
That's what I was thinking about doing, yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes. But I'm open to if we got only going to have so much time. I wanted to allow Senator Eaton a chance to lay out what it is that she's proposing, but not for us to take any action on it or to do anything more than that.
And Madam Chair, if we're going to have Senator Eaton's people who are flying in, then I think there should be opportunity for people to counter that point as well. And so I would hope you'd be open to that.
Well, we want to restrict the time, and of course we had I don't really want to have a hearing on the bill. So if we want to have an alternative perspective on the bill, and there's an organization or somebody that would like to step up to the plate to provide that, please contact me. But we're not having a full hearing on this bill. We're not going to take any action on the bill. In the same way that we had, Senator Nelson had some presentations done on the dementia initiative. So that's what we do sometimes.
Madam
we're not going to argue the bill.
And that would be what we weren't doing. I mean, we would want to just provide what the bill is, how it's being implemented in other states. And that would be the sum total of what we would do.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's just an informational presentation. I'd like to keep it to that.
I have a
We will have an opportunity for further discussion as we come back next year and as we go throughout the state and see how people are reacting to this idea.
But I'm fine with what she wants.
And, Madam Chair, given that the bill is not making deadline and you don't intend to take action, wouldn't it make more sense to move this to a time that wasn't a very crowded schedule?
Sure would make a lot more sense, but that's not what we're going to do. So we do a lot of nonsensical things around here. I'm making an accommodation. I accept the criticism. All right. Let's move to the next bill. 1771, Senator Diddle.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I appreciate your consideration of adding this bill to your agenda for consideration. And 35 seconds, I promise.
We got a timer.
So, Madam Chair and members, I do have an A3 delete all amendment that takes a lot of the bill, takes down the bill considerably.
Okay, thank you very much. The A3 amendment is in front of you. Senator Lori offers the A3 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
So, Madam Chair, members, Senate File 1771 are, for the most part, some technical changes to the medical cannabis legislation that was passed and enacted last year. The product that you see in front of you is the result of some work by the agency, though this is not an agency bill at this point, as well as some consultation with the stakeholders, in particular with the grower-manufacturer distributors of medical cannabis. Just to kind of button up some of the items, you know, how we always give it our best shot and then discover in actual implementation some details. Don't work quite right, or we didn't get them quite right. So I'll just walk through that very quickly. The first provision allows the commissioner to register or re-register manufacturers rather than every year, every 3 years, and they would still be subject to all of the analysis and all the qualifications, et cetera. The reason for that being is that the manufacturers, you know, develop a certain business model and a certain program, and they need a little bit more certainty for purposes of running their operation, their finances, et cetera, a little bit longer in length than every year. Every 3 years gives them a little more stability and predictability. The patient enrollment piece in Section 2, starting on line 2.3, that just ensures that a patient is not enrolled until after they pay their fees. That's the first part. And the second part gives a time limit for the commissioner to approve their application for participation to 30 days, except that this year a commissioner would have up to 60 days. And then it also provides, if you look a little further down on line 2.26, it just provides that the enrollment in the registry does cease upon the death of a patient. Probably a little self-evident, but I guess we needed to actually say that out loud. Moving on, line 3.22 in section 3. This is just a reflection of actuality, how the laboratories, these are the laboratories that are separate from the manufacturer, grower, distributors for the purposes of assuring quality, et cetera. So these separate entity laboratories are approved ahead of time rather than after the fact, after the manufacturer's contract with them. Makes a little bit more sense rather than having the manufacturers contract with laboratories and then have the approval follow later. This approval would follow before, and I guess that's how things are actually being implemented. Moving on to section 4 on page 4, down on line 4.27. This is the certified annual audit. Ensures that those audits start This year, it doesn't make any sense for any audits to have been done for previous year because there's really nothing to audit. And then finally, if members recall, this is section 5 now on page 5. Members recall there are only a certain number of qualifying medical conditions that were named at the outset. Then there's a process by which the commissioner can add additional conditions with some research, some examination, some study, and some reporting. And within that framework, legislature gave the commissioner to take a first look at intractable pain, and gave the commissioner a deadline of July of next year. That's moved up to January. I understand from the agency that work will all be completed by that time. It's in process now. Another part of the process is that once the commissioner names or nominates a condition to the list of qualifying medical conditions, there needs to be the opportunity for the legislature to act in some manner, typically in opposition if they don't want that condition to be added. And so this would allow for intractable pain if the commissioner finds that it should be added to the list of qualifying medical conditions to be placed on the list, allowing the legislature to act sometime between January and May of next year. And then if the legislature chooses to allow for that to occur, then folks with intractable pain would be patients who qualify for the program starting after the legislature adjourns. That's the extent of my bill. We have people here who can answer more detailed questions.
Great. We'll take questions now. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, I don't know that I'm comfortable with the every 3 years for re-registering. You're doing an annual audit anyway, and I would assume that unless there were some infractions, that it would be fairly routine unless there had been complaints or infractions. So I don't understand why we couldn't do an annual re-audit.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton.
Senator Dibble.
So the re-registration is a fairly intensive analysis and examination, and of course, it would mean that I think the manufacturers just would have a less stable, less secure business model upon which to operate, and of course, we know in the business world, a lot of plans are made over the long haul, and if they can't argue to their financiers and investors that they'll be in place for some period of time, their business model is just much less secure. That's what I think is the reason, but tell me I'm completely wrong.
Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, Manny Munson-Regala, Assistant Commissioner from the Minnesota Department of Health. With respect to Senator Eaton's question, the first thing I'd note is that the certified annual audit is a financial audit. It's not a performance audit or compliance audit. So for our purposes, we're going to be conducting our own periodic quality and performance reviews. We've already initiated that process of inspections with the manufacturers to look at their production. They certainly haven't done any distribution yet, which would start in July, but we would envision engaging in that process. From the department's perspective, the value of moving to a three-year registration period is primarily around ensuring patient access. One of our challenges about doing a re-registration process every year is potentially creating a dynamic where patients who are expecting and relying on certain medications may be put at risk if, in fact, we have to deregister a manufacturer during that time period. The registration process did take quite a bit of time on our part, and we are prepared to do that if necessary. Right now, the way the law is structured, the tool we have is essentially the death penalty. We can tell a manufacturer, you're done and you're out of business. We would prefer not to have to pull that club out every year, but prefer the opportunity to do it perhaps in a little bit more structured way, which is why we're okay with moving to a three-year registration time period.
Senator Nelson, then Senator Rosen, and Senator Benson all have questions, and then we'll need to be moving our agenda along. I'm hoping we can resolve this. If we can't, we'll have to
move forward. Cut the deal with you. If we don't finish this in 10 minutes, we table the bill.
That's
so y'all
right.
can kill the bill if you keep asking questions.
Yeah.
So
Madam Chair?
Yes. So, Senator Nelson, please begin, and to the point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. I just have a couple quick points. One has to do with the three-year registration window. So many other things in our state require one-year registrations, which are not nearly as, one would say, innovative or not having the track that have stronger track records and history than this does. So I'm a little concerned about that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble,
If this is a serious enough concern, we can just strike that section. This is not that big a deal.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And second question. There's a motion on the table to strike on line 1.19 every 3 years and restore of each year.
Madam Chair, the motion would be to delete section one, I think.
Oh, okay, to delete section one.
And
thank you.
Madam Chair, this will be going to finance?
This goes to finance.
I believe there are costs.
Yes, it is going to finance.
All right, so.
Well, my second question, Madam Chair.
Hold on just a second here. Slow down.
That was very brief, but my second question.
Yeah, we have a motion here.
Oh, so
Senator Rosen, to the motion.
To that motion, Madam Chair, does that mean that there's no registration? We just want to strike the language every 3 years. Okay, we need to clarify that then. Because right. The motion was to strike section one.
Then existing law would remain, which is each year.
Right.
So the motion is, Ms. Kavanaugh, would you read the motion to us?
Madam Chair and members, it's to delete section one.
Okay. All right, on the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay.
No.
Let's do that again. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
No.
The motion does not pass.
It will.
Okay, Senator Rosen. You had another question, yep. Senator Nelson, and Senator Rosen.
Just a brief comment regarding the need for longer term, and this isn't an issue here, but because you struck it. But my understanding from the reports was that the real issue that was giving the manufacturers problems getting financial resources was the fact, not because of a one-year or three-year registration, but the real issue was that they were concerned that the feds could come in at any time and shut them down. So I just think that's an important thing to get on the record, that I think the real concern, has been reported, has been the fact that the feds could continually come in and shut this down at any minute.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the budget reconciliation bill passed by Congress last year, Congress did direct the Department of Justice and defunded any ability for the Department of Justice to enforce in any states that have medical cannabis laws.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, obviously I have some questions about this section. And Senator Dibble, is there a fee on the registration every year?
Senator Dibble?
Well, I'll ask Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there is not.
There is not. And Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator
this
Rosen.
Is a highly, it should be a highly regulated section. I think going from 1 to 3 years is quite a stretch. We talk about the intensive analysis and, you know, having patient access. So I would move that on 1.9, we strike every 3 years and move it to every 2 years.
There's a motion to strike every 3 years and replace it with every 2 years. Senator Nelson.
I'm confused. I thought we just deleted section one.
No, it failed. It failed.
Failed.
It failed.
Okay. Yes,
okay. Senator Laurie.
I'd support that motion as well. Maybe we should just.
To go to 2 years, you're talking about?
2 years.
All right. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. We'll say nay. The motion passes. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And now that we've had the three-year discussion, this might not be as relevant. But Commissioner Munson-Ragala, as you monitor performance, do you have authority to shut down a facility that's out of compliance, even if it's not time for their registration.
I'm sorry. Please introduce. Whoever's going to answer the question, please identify yourself and answer the question.
Madam Chair, Madam Manny Munson-Vergala, Senator Benson, no, we do not.
Okay. Is that a question, Senator Rosen, with your hand?
No.
No, okay. Very well. So I need a motion from Senator Lori that we will move Senate File
1771 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you very much. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Carlson.
We have this room until 10 o'clock.
Or 10:30?
Okay. Thank you. Chelsea, I got to work on her.
Senator Carlson, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. What is anaphylaxis? Well, we have Senate File 1580 to present to you the ability to stock epinephrine injectors in various places where they may be needed as an emergency treatment, somewhat like defibrillators. Anaphylaxis is a life-threatening allergic reaction. It can be manifested as hives, throat constriction, respiratory distress, vomiting, edema, blood pressure drop, and shock. Anaphylaxis can be triggered by foods such as peanuts or milk, insect venom, bee stings, or medications such as penicillin. A mild allergic reaction can escalate into anaphylaxis within 2 minutes. Senate File 1580 is a bill that will prevent needless deaths from simple things that seem unthreatening to most of us. Peanuts, insect bites, even buttermilk pancakes. You may have seen a WCCO story last week about a Bemidji teen who died this past summer from eating pancakes that he thought were dairy-free but were not. He had forgotten his EpiPen and sadly died from a severe allergic reaction to dairy. Despite extraordinary cautions exercised by parents and allergic individuals, severe allergic reactions cause approximately 1,500 deaths annually, with children and adolescents most at risk. It's estimated 1 in 13 children in the U.S. has a food allergy. There are approximately 90,000 emergency department visits each year in the U.S. due to anaphylaxis. This bill builds on current Minnesota law that permits schools to maintain and use epinephrine auto-injectors for individuals believed to be suffering an anaphylaxis incident or an allergic reaction. It will allow additional entities to obtain epinephrine auto-injectors so that their trained staff may use them with individuals without a prescription if necessary. This bill specifies these authorized entities as such as recreation camps, colleges and universities, daycares and preschools, and the Department of Health has the authority in the future to identify additional categories of authorized entities, which could include restaurants, amusement parks, or other locations where people come into contact with common allergies. This is entirely voluntary for any authorized entity. If an organization wants to obtain epinephrine auto-injectors for this purpose, their employees must receive training from a nationally recognized organization or another organization approved by the Department of Health. The training must include how to recognize signs and symptoms of severe allergic reactions and emergency follow-up procedures. The training organization will provide a certificate of training that can be provided to a pharmacy licensed as a wholesaler or a manufacturer to purchase the epinephrine auto-injector and have it available in the event that an individual is believed to be experiencing an allergic reaction. There is good immunity from liability for any entity acting in good faith under the law. When someone suffers an allergic reaction, timing is critical. Lives can be saved by having epinephrine auto-injectors available for use by trained individuals in more locations throughout the state. We've been working with various stakeholders on this bill, including the Department of Health, and will continue to get the best possible language to accomplish the goal. I have two individuals here to testify in support of the bill. We have Nona Narvaez, the director of Anaphylaxis and Food Allergy Association of Minnesota, and her son, Max Narvaez. Thank you, and we'll proceed with testimony.
Thank you. Welcome, Nona Narvaez and Max. Who would begin? Who would like to begin?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nona Narvaez, and I serve pro bono as the Executive Director of the Anaphylaxis and Food Allergy Association of Minnesota, AFA, and we heartily endorse this bill, not only on behalf of the 200,000 Minnesotans that have food allergies, but those that have insect bite allergies and those that have medication allergies and those that do not know that they have allergies but may have a first-time reaction in locations where this legislation could be quite helpful. I'm going to let my son tell his story, but I also want to recognize these two young girls here who are 9 years old. They are Josie and Anna Pitts. They are the youth ambassadors for the Food Allergy Awareness Walk, which is our organization's fundraiser on March 28th of this year, in about a week. And this is their mother, Melanie Pitts, and she's also a nurse. So if you have additional questions, we are available.
I welcome Max to the committee, but I also would like, would you say the names of the young people that are representatives again?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Anna and Josie.
Thank you. Anna and Josie, welcome to the committee. We really appreciate you coming, and I hope after Max is done that you'll tell us a little something about yourselves on the microphone so that you'll be on the tape. So, Max, please proceed.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Max Narvaez. I'm known as Sun. I am mainly the reason that we started a nonprofit organization in Minnesota. And so I've survived through multiple anaphylactic reactions myself, some more severe than others. I've outgrown 6 allergens, but I'm still allergic to milk, eggs, tree nuts, beef, pork, and told to avoid fish and shellfish. Anaphylactic reactions can occur in an individual, and the symptoms and time before the reaction occurs can vary greatly within the same individual. I've had reactions that have sent me to the hospital. One time, I was in Spring Valley, Minnesota, about an hour south of Rochester. We were at a camp discussing with the director if I could safely go there later that summer for a camp. And so we had eaten some food at a restaurant in Rochester previously, about an hour before. And so then my symptoms were for that reaction were a rash, watery eyes and nose, nausea, and vomiting, and they all gradually developed over the course of an hour as we drove to the camp. My parents administered epinephrine right away, and the symptoms disappeared within 30 seconds, and I felt better in about 45 seconds. But one interesting part about that is that I coughed once after the epi was administered, which shows that if we had not administered the epinephrine right away, I might not have been able to survive much longer after if we had waited, say, a minute or two even. So, another time I was having a salad at home, and I reached for the wrong salad dressing, one with egg. The package looked the same as the egg-free one, so easy mistake to make. I immediately realized my mistake and spat it out, but even so, my throat started closing. So, that time was only about 1 minute before the symptoms started showing. Big difference between first and second ones. So, my throat closing meant that I wouldn't be able to ingest any more egg, which was my body's intention, but also I couldn't ingest oxygen, just bad side effect. So, if my parents hadn't taught me to carry epinephrine, the 15-minute ambulance arrival time in southern Minnesota would have probably been fatal for me. So, imagine This happened to a camper who was having a first-time reaction, undiagnosed, no idea what's going on, just at a camp doing whatever they would do. Or imagine a college student who knows they have an allergy and they carry a prescription, but they only carry one auto-injector and they need more than that. Or someone at the Minnesota State Fair or Minnesota Zoo or baseball stadiums or just sports stadiums, because or even shopping mall, because they have the emergency services, but it takes a while for them to get anywhere because of the sheer size of the space that they have to cover. So this is why it's important for us to let venues obtain non-specific epinephrine to use in case of an anaphylactic emergency, and it could and probably will save lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Max. Thank you very much. Anna. Anna, would you like to just say hi and tell us what grade you're in?
Hi, and I'm in third grade.
Well, thank you for coming today. Are you going to run for the Minnesota Senate someday? Say maybe. Maybe. Okay. And,
Madam Chair, Anna is from Apple Valley.
And from Apple Valley, okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. And Josie?
My name is Josie, and I'm in third grade.
And you're also from Apple Valley? And are you going to run for the Minnesota Senate someday? Maybe. No. Say maybe.
No.
Maybe not. Maybe not.
I'm some performance here.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. No.
Thank you. She is not ready to announce her intent.
I see. We would welcome you.
Exploratory committees.
Thank you so much for coming here today. Are there any questions on the bill?
I believe there's an amendment.
Oh, there is an amendment.
Chair,
okay,
thank you. We have an amendment that gets it into the shape that we need.
Thank you. This is the A1 amendment. Senator Eaton offers the A1 amendment. It's a delete everything amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Senator Marty, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, Ms. Narvaez, I remember when Max was much smaller and she was pushing this, and is one who's had family members years before these who almost died from this sort of thing. And as a son who carries this all the time, and knowing how he gave me about a one-minute training on how to use it if it ever happens, I'm just curious why you would require a camp or something. I mean, they have to be trained medically. They have to have training in the use of this before the camp can get any or a place like that. Isn't this something that people should be trained in it, but saying we can't get them to the camp until, I mean, who all has to be trained? One person or all the staff or whatever?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, the training is important for people to understand.
Narvaez, yes.
Thank you. The training is important for people to understand what the symptoms of anaphylaxis are, because they can vary so greatly, even in the same individual. Like my son Max explained, one time he had vomiting and he had a butterfly rash and watery eyes. Next time he had none of those symptoms, but his throat was closing up. And when he was an infant, he had totally different symptoms. He threw up and he had hives. He hasn't had hives for years now. So I think it's very important to do the training piece so that people will recognize anaphylaxis, because very often they think something else is going on and they don't recognize it for what it is.
Senator Marty, there's another question. Senator Marty, we need to move along.
Chair, Ms. Narvaez, I understand the importance of training. I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying that I don't know how the commissioner, I mean, if there's a camp, say the one he was going to, if they have 30 employees, I mean, in effect, the commissioner just says, have you been trained, and then they can get the prescription for them, or is it that they have to certify some? I was just curious, Senator Carlson, what your intent is there.
Yep. Senator Carlson?
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, we have it in there that you have a certificate that you have done the training.
Any further discussion on the bill?
And Madam Chair,
Senator Carlson,
You know, I want to tell you a little bit about my background in this. I knew nothing about it about 12 years ago, and it was 12 years ago I brought this particular pen to room 15, and I was the person who was training the committee in a conference committee. And I want you to watch carefully. This is how you use it. That's it. So that's this is a very simple device, and it saves lives.
Senator Hayden?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Thank you very much. On the bill, I've got to get the number in front of me here. Senate File 1580 as amended be passed and referred to Judiciary as the motion. And Senator Hayden, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you very much. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for appearing, Senator Jensen, on your bill. We have a tight schedule. We're hoping that you'll get to the bill, the essence of the bill, and that the committee gets a chance to ask it questions within a defined time.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I do have an amendment, a delete all amendment, the A1, if someone would move that for me.
Senator Rosen offers the amendment, A1 amendment.
What the A1 amendment does is it matches the language and a few changes that were made in the House. And I have Randy Schneider here that could talk about the changes that were made in the House. This is a bill that was heard last year by this committee and had no controversy in this committee last year. The Board of Optometry has been working on the changes in their board procedures for about 5 years. Now it must be six. And so a lot of work has gone into this bill, and it has been heard before this committee before.
But it's a delete all amendment.
It
correct?
Is a delete all.
So why don't we have a motion? We have a motion from Senator Rosen on the A1 delete all amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Okay, it passes, so we can get right to the essence of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first sections of the bill, and I can do each section if you want, or we can talk. I can let Randy Schneider walk through it if you would prefer.
Whichever your preference is, just one walkthrough and highlighting the essence of each that you think this committee needs to understand in terms of the policy in the bill.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Randy Snyder, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Optometry, and I'll make this very brief. Lines 1, 1, 2, 5, 3, 3 are obsolete statutes. There is a 5-year roll-in of some educational requirements that sunsetted in 2013, and so those need to be removed in order to have contemporary standards. The next section will be going to finance, that is fees. We have not increased our fees. This is lines 5.13 to 5.26. And I will stand for questions after that. But lines 5.13 to 5.26 are fees increased that will be going to the Finance Committee. We have not increased fees for 27 years. I want to always bring that up. I don't get to say that often, but that will be heard later. And the third part, those were the essential elements. The third part were to look at what are best practices currently for grounds of discipline for boards, and that is where we opened it up. We went to the Board of Medical Practice, which has all the intent of the statutes have been thoroughly vetted prior by other committees, and so we merely mirrored what they had. They're also recognized nationally through the Federation of State Medical Boards, and what we did was to match them entirely. They were reviewed last year, Madam Chair, and there weren't really that many suggestions for change on that at all. What we did eliminate in this bill were sections on temporary suspension, emergency suspension, and that is in a separate bill, and Madam Chair, that is your bill, Senate File 1521. So we eliminated that from last year's bill, but that's in essence really what all has happened. There is no opposition. There is no opposition last year in this committee or in the House at this moment. So it stands clean. It is ready to be moved forward, and I will stand for questions.
Are there any questions? Senator Hayden.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Senator Hayden would like to move Senate File 383 as amended to be passed and referred to finance. Is there any further discussion? Thank you very much for your presentation. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes.
Thank you.
Our next bill is there moving forward will be Senator Nelson's Senate File 1757. And as they approach, I'm glad to see Senator Hayden coming to the committee and moving things along for us here.
I was going to do that.
I'm sorry, Senator.
Senator
Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for hearing Senate File 1757. And I also would like to thank the co-sponsors on this legislation, Senators Dietzick, Senjum, and Franson. I have also a brief author's amendment that I would like to make at this time. It is the first stop for the bill. And, Madam Chair, it is an oral amendment. It's very brief. So if I could direct members to Senate File 1757 and line 1.11, delete the last two words, used as. On line 1.13, insert the word after are furnished, insert the word exclusively. To patients, comma, their families, comma, and then insert the word caregivers. So the line 1.11 would read, well, I don't need to read that. Line 1.13 would read, are furnished exclusively to parents, their families, and caregivers while the patient is receiving or waiting to receive.
And you meant patients instead of parents, correct? Are furnished exclusively
yes, patients.
To patients and their families, comma, or patients, comma, and their families,
yes.
comma,
and caregivers.
And caregivers while patients.
Correct.
All those in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a very small bill. It does one thing. I'm going to tell you about it and then turn it over to my testifiers. Senate File 1757 amends the lodging establishment statute to include long-term medical lodging. And because time is brief, I'm going to turn it directly over to my two testifiers to tell you what that is and why it's important to not just Rochester but other communities. And so I'd like to introduce Jody Hook from Serenity House.
Good morning. I'm Jody Hook. I'm the president of Serenity House Network. We have 18 fully furnished apartments and homes that are exclusively for medical patients, their families, and their caregivers that are receiving treatment actively at Mayo Clinic while they're in Rochester, Minnesota. I'm a former bone marrow transplant nurse and feel a strong passion for providing safe medical housing for patients as they go through outpatient treatments. We use the same cleaning products as Mayo does in their transplant rooms in our houses. I'm here to advocate for patients needing safe, high-quality lodging accommodations. One thing I'd like to share is a patient testimonial of a guest that stayed with us. He's actually a physician himself, and he stayed with us for 3 months after his heart transplant. He says, I had been hospitalized at St. Mary's Hospital from July 3, 2013 until December 12, 2013. I received a heart transplant on November 28th. For my family and for myself, it had been a long journey. We were all tired. We needed a warm, nurturing environment for all of us to heal. I craved solitude after months of not having this in the hospital. It was holiday time, and because we rented through Serenity House Network, my children, wife, and I were all able to stay together. We cooked several holiday dinners and opened presents in our private living room. There was even a Christmas tree provided by SHN. While we were not home, this became home. And for all of us, it was the best Christmas we had ever had. We were back to being the wonderful family that we are. We were happy and joyous. Serenity House Network helped to give this back to us. Serenity House Network is focused on the need to provide a clean environment. They provide an environment that is peaceful and restful. The apartment is bright and sunny. It is an environment that promotes healing not only physically but also spiritually and emotionally. I wish more transplant patients were aware of this fabulous option. I am a physician and my wife is a nurse, and we are both impressed by the high quality of the service that is offered at Serenity House Network. Sincerely, Stephen Turchin, MD. And then I just wanted to end with a guest that stopped in this week to find out more information about us. It was a young couple. When she walked in, she explained that she had been diagnosed with cancer during her pregnancy and is now in need of a 100-day transplant. So she needs a place where her 3-month-old baby and her 3-and-a-half-year-old can stay with them. She doesn't want to be separated from her family during this time. And that's my passion, is for families to be able to be together as they receive extended treatment. Because some of those families only have a limited number of days left together, and they can never get those days back.
Well, thank you, Ms. Hook. Thank you. And thank you for your passion for this service. Is this Brad Jones from the Convention and Visitors
yes.
Bureau?
Madam President, committee members, I would like to introduce Brad Jones.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you. Just briefly, I've provided a letter of support for Senate File 1757. As the CEO of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, we've discussed this issue for a few years now. We've worked with community stakeholders to come to this point and what we feel is the right thing to do. As you can imagine, we have hundreds of long-term medical patients a day in Rochester, and that's soon to grow. For those of you who don't know, we will be opening the new Proton Beam Cancer Center. That's slated to handle about 2,500 new cancer treatment patients every year, annually. Many of those are pediatric cancer cases that will be coming to Minnesota and to Rochester. More specifically, these patients, long-term medical patients, require a more home-like atmosphere for many different reasons. And we, as an organization, need these, and as a city and destination, need these licensed and inspected as lodging facilities. That's what they're acting as, for transient lodging in our city, and this bill would accomplish that for us. I would assume that there's some other needs around the state as well, around medical, cancer, transplant centers as well. But we're in full support of this. I have 6,000 hotel rooms nearly in our city. We've gathered, we've discussed this, and they understand that these long-term patients require a more home-like situation than a traditional lodging. So I would be glad to stand for any questions that you may have.
The one question that I would have is, I understand that you then would be able to present patients with a list of licensed facilities that might offer this special kind of support for long-term care. But does it prohibit others who might be willing to advertise themselves as being open to the idea of sharing their home?
Yeah, Madam Chair, committee, there are lots of distribution systems for lodging establishments, but our patients and guests specifically come to our site to vet those options. And currently we require licensing as a lodging establishment, proper insurance, proof of insurance, and
Mr. Jones,
yes.
Let me make sure you're answering my question. So if they come to you and what you're describing now, those requirements must be there in order for you to to present an option back to your customers.
That's correct.
But if somebody else wants to go on Craigslist or something and advertise themselves directly, they can still do that. Is that true?
Madam Chair and committee, yes, that happens in the industry. Yet our guests and visitors really look for that stamp of approval on where they want to stay.
And I understand that. I just wanted to know if that's still an option out there. I understand what you're describing, so I've had my question answered.
Correct.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I like your logo, by the way, your rah-rah Rochester. But question with these becoming lodging establishments, I think with the destination bill, we gave Rochester a fairly substantial local lodging tax. Is the intent to include these in that lodging tax or not include them in the lodging tax? If so, is that something Rochester City Council can choose to do or not choose to do, or is a lodging establishment hit with the tax automatically? That's partly Rochester's issue, but because this does apply statewide, I'm just curious what it would do for others. What's the intent and how does it play out?
Senator Nelson or Mr. Jones? Senator
Nelson. And then we'll turn it over to Mr. Jones. Rochester has spoken about this. It has gone through the City Council. Serenity House, other similar establishments want this higher level of inspection and the lodging tax that goes with it.
We already pay the lodging tax. So.
Okay. Seeing no more questions, Senator Nelson?
Madam Chair, I will just move the bill, and then I'll just mention the other facilities that might be of interest. Hennepin County Medical Center, North Lamar Children's Hospital, Gillette Children's Hospital, Specialty Health, University of Minnesota Transplant and Children's Hospital, Essentia Health, St. Mary's Medical Center in St. Luke's, and Mayo Clinic. There are several who I think this would benefit. And with that, Madam Chair, did you have something else to say?
No, Senator Marty and Madam Chair, I just wanted to mention that's an important part of this, is to put these establishments on the same level as lodging establishments, and the taxation, inspection, and licensure is very important to not only guests but also purveyors of these establishments. So if we can treat them on the level, I think that's an important part of this bill.
And Madam Chair, might I just add that it's sculpted very narrowly as you read the bill, so that it's within that 10-mile distance from those medical facilities. And so with that, there might be another testifier, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't have them on the list. I should have invited other testifiers. Excuse me.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tony Kulis, representing Hospitality Minnesota, which is the umbrella organization of the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association, the Minnesota Lodging Association, and the Minnesota Restaurant Association. Madam Chair, just that we are in support of 1757. We had a couple of concerns about some of the language that you have touched on a little bit today about lodging taxes, but this is a unique situation, we think, and as Ms. Hook and Senator Nelson have pointed out, and look forward to working with them as we try and make sure that the focus is narrowed down. As you can imagine, when we start to deal with the lodging definition, there are some concerns among the industry, but I think we can reach some of the concerns that we have with Senator Nelson and the interested parties.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kulis. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on this bill before we call for a motion? Seeing no one, Senator Nelson?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 1757 pass and
as amended.
And is there another committee stop, or is it right?
Finance.
Finance. Senator Lori would like to hear the bill.
Yes.
All right. And move to finance.
All right. Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Passes. Thank you very much, Senator Nelson.
Thank you.
Senate File 1311.
Yes, thank you very much. I have an A1 amendment.
Senator Sharon offers the A1 amendment, which is in our packets. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
And we also have an oral amendment to
line 6.25. On that line, we need to change health, the term health, to human services.
Okay. So Senator Sharon moves the oral amendment on line 6.25 to change the word health, or delete health and insert human services. All members clear on that oral amendment? Any questions? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to have Ms. App in because we're really trying to keep our time short because of the room. I would like to ask Ms. Abderholden to articulate the essence of the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. This bill does a couple of things. It really is trying to address the suicide problem in our state. In 2001, we had 475 suicides. In 2012, we had 660, and so that rate is going up. The bill adds to the current teacher licensure renewal program, just adds the topic of suicide prevention to the list of topics that they can get trained on. Teachers have to have continuing education on the early warning signs of mental illness when they renew their license. The second thing is to really expand the suicide prevention programs that are run by the Department of Health to make sure that they're really doing more outreach in the community, especially for people who work with youth, and to do what's called postvention training. Everyone knows what prevention is. Postvention is coming into a community after a suicide takes place to make sure there isn't contagion and things like that, and to really help that community heal and make sure that we don't have any further suicides. The third issue is to really look at the collection and reporting of suicide data. I can tell you today how many people in Africa have Ebola. I cannot tell you today how many people died by suicide in Hennepin County last month or the month before that or the month before that. It's often 1 to 2 years old. This is a public health issue. We cannot address it that way. We need to try to figure out how to do this better and to really help those communities. And this would have the commissioner consult with stakeholders and come back next year with a report to you about how we can improve on that. And then the last two things is one is appropriating some additional dollars to the commissioner of health. We actually only spend $98,000 a year in grants to the community on suicide prevention activities and a small amount of money, $48,000, for administration at the state. So we're increasing those dollars and then also kind of refunding the Youth Mental Health First Aid program that you did in 2013, which has proven to be really successful. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, would you like your other testifiers?
Yes, I think we'll just proceed with the testimonies.
Okay, welcome, and please introduce yourself for the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sean Haynes. I'm here today to tell you about my 15-year-old daughter who we lost to suicide on December 29th of 2011. Alyssa was a beautiful girl, typical teenage girl. Her life revolved around friends and family, and being a teenager, her cell phone was always stuck to her side. With that said, though, Alyssa was an excellent student. She always earned A's and B's in school, and her teachers always had great things to say about her. But more importantly, she was my little girl. She was my pride and joy. Though Alyssa was only 15 years old, she always spoke about her future. Her plans were to go to New York for college and become a forensic scientist. That was her dreams. On the morning of December 29, 2011, my world was shattered. We had just finished up Christmas gatherings with our family, and we were getting packed and ready to take a trip to northern Minnesota. It was about 10 a.m., and I decided it was time to wake up my little girl. I ran up the stairs, and as I opened the door, I had found my little girl had taken her life. This is an image that's forever burned into my mind, something that I revisit daily, multiple times. You see, everything I told you about Alyssa is true. She had a heart of gold. She loved her friends and to be around family. She loved to hang out with her little brother, and she always walked around with a smile on her face. From the outside, she appeared to have everything, but what my little girl never shared, what she never told anybody, was she was fighting a battle that she chose to fight on her own, a battle with depression that she lost on that December morning. I'll never know why Alyssa chose to not tell anybody she was struggling. Was it because she was embarrassed due to the stigma we still have around mental health? Was it because she didn't know where to get help? I may never know, but what I do know is we can prevent another family from having to experience this pain. We can prevent another little brother the heartache of wondering where his sister is. We simply can do this through education and support programs. It took months after Alyssa had passed away for the cloud of grief to lift enough for my wife and I to be able to think clearly again. We came to the conclusion that we couldn't just sit here and do nothing. We cannot let another family feel this pain we were submerged in. We started doing hours of research online and in our community, and we found some incredible mental health groups out there. However, up to that point, we had never even heard of them before. We knew we needed to assist these groups to expand. We wanted to make sure everyone knew what to do and where to go when they were hurting. With the help of friends and family, my wife and I started a nonprofit group called Stomp Out Suicide. Our goal is to raise awareness about mental health and suicide prevention. With that said, we started putting on events to raise money so we can deliver best practice and evidence-based programs to schools throughout the state of Minnesota. We also know that without the backing from the state, getting these programs in so every person in Minnesota has easy access to them is an extremely tall task. I'll never forget looking at the CDC website and reading about suicide as the second leading cause of death between the ages of 15 and 24, yet before my daughter had passed, I hardly read anything about it. Every 13 minutes, we lose someone to suicide in this country, someone's dad or mom, someone's friend, and someone's daughter. Even though my family has gone through some very dark and confusing times after losing our daughter, I can tell you with certainty this. Even with Stomp Out Suicide being a small organization, we receive numerous emails and phone calls each week from people from all around Minnesota, thanking us for getting them in contact with groups like Canvas Health and NAMI, other support groups around the state of Minnesota. These groups are irreplaceable and need your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Haynes, and so sorry for your loss. Thank you for sharing your story and finding a way to help more people with it.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
I think that we've presented the essence of the bill, getting data so we can see trends, collecting that information. We need to understand, I think, that Ms. Abderholden's example of our recognition of Ebola around the world is more comprehensive than we are looking at our own suicide rates. And what I particularly appreciate in this recommendation is the efforts towards a broad training program for people on recognizing and helping de-escalate and intervene in situations which there's obvious increased agitation and anxiety that only increases when you apply traditional ways of dealing with that, because the person's misinterpreting the need for space or for or even understanding that somebody's feeling very threatened. And how do you reduce the threat in order to de-escalate the situation? So, and this requires, you know, just people to become more conscious and intentional about their interaction. This pairs very nicely with other concerns you've heard in front of the committee about creating an alternative to jails through a hub because somebody has, you know, demonstrated a lot of agitation and anxiety. So this skill set is really important to develop in lots of places throughout the state. So with that, I'd put it in front of the committee, and I'm hoping that we gain your support.
Members, any questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Haynes, I was wondering if there's any other programs, such as the one that you and your wife developed, that are going into the schools and talking to schools or any other organizations that can have a personal touch.
Ms. Abdul?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. There are a couple. What we're trying to make sure of is that people are actually using best practices and evidence-based. What often happens is families want to go in and share their story, and that can be actually the worst thing that you can do in a high school, because what you want to do is not have the students focus on the actual death. What you want them to do is understand the warning signs and what to do, both for yourself and for your classmates. So there is a program out of our national office called Ending the Silence. There is a suicide survivor training that we actually found some grant money for and are collaborating with the Department of Health to bring in within the next 2 weeks a training so that people learn how to say, you know, to tell their stories appropriately in a way that is helpful and not hurtful. There's a program actually that was developed at why am I blanking on the name in your community? Hazleton. Need to finish that cup of coffee. Hazleton Foundation also has a program. We actually, and just in full disclosure, we have a small grant from the Department of Health, $15,000 a year, to actually train healthcare providers, mental health providers, teachers, et cetera, about how you teach families to keep their children and adolescents safe, and we hand out lock boxes so they can put all their medications. People usually think about locking up their prescription meds, but not things like Tylenol, which can be really harmful to young people, and you have those bottles everywhere in your house. So we provide those lock boxes to people. So there's a couple of different programs, but frankly, you know, the small amount of money that comes out of, you know, the suicide prevention grants, and it's not easy, frankly, to raise, you know, money from foundations and things like that. SAVE also has a program that goes into the schools as well.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I failed to emphasize another really important part of this as we're talking here. I don't know if in your community's members, but certainly in my community, where you've had a suicide, and then you start this copycat kind of a concept. This bill also talks about, and Ms. Abdelden talked about it too, but I just want to emphasize that it's important that there be more effective response in the school system to suicide, because it can sort of have a snowball effect that can really be a disaster in a community. So that there's an effort in this bill to begin to try to intervene in that post-suicide situation as well.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Abderholden, you know what I'm going to say. I mean, we have a lot of initiatives going to mental health and absolutely necessary, fully support everything. But we have gaps. We don't know where the funding's going, what the funding has done. At some point, like I said, the big white board or whatever you can do to help us fill in those gaps and make sure that we are doing it properly. There's no redundant. And that, this is probably a conversation for finance, but at some point, it'd be nice to just have it all spread out on the table and figure out what are we doing for mental health and where have we failed and where are the successes.
And Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it's in progress, and I'm hoping to have it for you next week.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Senator Wicklund, that's exactly why this committee has had the gap analysis presentation, so that the things that you're looking at here are related to that hearing that we had on gaps analysis. These are related to an already designed presentation of where the gaps are in the mental health system. This is a part of a series of initiatives that are very much directed to that gap analysis. I thought you were going to ask Senator Rosen whether or not these would be distributed, these resources would be distributed.
I'm sure.
So, how they would be distributed throughout the state, and so that they certainly have the benefit of the rural area. And so I'm going to be looking down at that because I should have cued in on that myself.
Mm-hmm. And?
Senator Rosen did.
The And Madam Chair, the answer is yes. And I can bring you the data from the last portion of the suicide grants. I know in the ones that we had, we definitely went across the state of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there others who wish to testify on this bill? Mr. Heller?
Thank you. Chair and
Mr. Heller,
members, my name is Rick Heller. Unofficially represent the Twice Exceptional. Speak it on Senate File 1311 on suicide prevention and training. Just for the record, I think it's important that mental health is essential for engagement. The Minnesota survey, which checks the students' motivation, that survey is missing an important component based on No Child Left Behind under Definition F. And this has to do with motivation and development of reading. I'm a firm believer that those kids that are not motivated and their reading don't develop are the kids that are falling in the gaps here regarding depression and anxiety. And hopefully this training will include that. Look for the flags of the kids that don't enjoy reading, because they're in a rich environment of materials they need to be engaged in. And achievement is about access, and IQ is about opportunity. Hopefully these best practices that the teachers are going to be being exposed to will also include how to make sure those students get appropriate access based on principles of universal design. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Senator Sharon?
Thank you very much.
I would be willing to move Senate File 1311 as amended be passed and referred to Finance.
On Senator Sharon's motion, is there any other discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Your motion passes. Thank you.
Senator Wicklund, welcome. 1637.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I Senate File 1637 has to do with modifying requirements for child care assistance, redeterminations of eligibility, and recovery of overpayments. Just at a high level, this bill will change the redetermination period from the current 6 months to 12 months for determining the eligibility for child care assistance. Just over the sections of the bill, the other section 4 of the bill also simplifies the recovery of CCAP overpayments. And I believe this bill is coming before you because I believe it's important that we look at what the factors are for families, low-income families, on child care assistance. And continuity of caregiver is something that's really important for children, children's health and growth, infants through school age. This would apply to kids from 0 to through school age. And increasing the length of time between reauthorizations will help low-income families that have jobs that may have difficult schedules. They may have other issues with housing stability, other challenges such as transportation. Extending the length of time to 12 months will allow them to know that their child has continuity of care for that period of time. And I have two testifiers here today, Sarah Benzkofer, who is here from Minnesota Association for the Education of Young Children and the Minnesota School Age Care Alliance, and then Tricia Olson, who is from the YWCA of Minneapolis. And did you want to go first? Well, Sarah Benzkofer, go first.
Welcome, Ms. Benzkofer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Benzkofer. I'm the Director of Policy and Communications at the Minnesota Association for the Education of Young Children and the Minnesota School Age Care Alliance. We represent over 1,300 early childhood and school age care professionals working primarily in child care centers and school district school age care programs. Thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of Senate File 1637, which Senator Wicklund said would change the authorization period in the child care assistance program from 6 months to 12 months. According to a survey conducted by Wilder Research in 2009, of the 908,000 Minnesota children under the age of 12, almost 600,000 are in some sort of child care arrangement, and over 225,000 are in a full-day, full-year child care. We also know from the recent Department of Human Services Child Care Assistance Family Profile that nearly 50,000 children 0 to 12 are receiving child care assistance. Early childhood and school age care provide a safe, nurturing, age-appropriate environment for these children. These programs provide important early learning and after-school opportunities so that families can be in work. What we know is that the best learning happens when there are ongoing and consistent interactions between the teacher in the classroom and the child. Our experience has been that with the six-month reauthorizations, many families experience a lapse in the authorization that results in what is commonly referred to as a revolving door of care. Children will be in child care for a few months, then absent for many weeks, and then returning again over and over. With each lapse in service, children experience a process of catching up with their peers and thus never receive the full benefits of these important early learning opportunities. The reason behind these lapses vary. They may include a missed signature, a paycheck stub, received one day late, or lost paperwork at the county office. And many of these families that lose their authorization are still eligible to receive child care assistance. So ultimately, it is the child that loses the most. Last November, Congress passed and the President signed the reauthorization of the Child Care Development Block Grant, and there are many improvements to the law, and one of them is requiring every state to move to this 12-month annual reauthorization. And we say, let's not wait. Let's be at the forefront of this and pass this child-focused and family-friendly policy and make a positive and profound impact on children's lives today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Benz-Kofer.
Kofer, yep. Kofer.
Tricia Olson.
Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tricia Olson, and I'm an early childhood education specialist at the YWCA Children's Center in Minneapolis. I'm here today because I care about children and their families. I believe that all children deserve access and opportunity to affordable and quality child care. I work with families from various backgrounds, and the one thing I've learned is that consistency and attendance in a quality child care program affords children the opportunity to grow and be successful at school as well as home. When CCAP authorizations are jeopardized, it impacts the success of the child and the family by breaking that consistency. When CCAP authorizations end every 6 months, families can lose authorization for various reasons, such as Sarah had mentioned, missing paperwork, missing a signature, or sometimes and most often waiting on their caseworker. I'm not here today to complain or put the blame on caseworkers. I recognize they have large caseloads. I'm here to talk about how it affects our families. Oftentimes, there's nothing the parent or us as a YWCA child care center can do when waiting on an authorization. As a former teacher, I have personally witnessed family distress when childcare authorizations are lost. I've seen the pain. I have felt the tears on my shoulders as I've hugged families as they've said goodbye, not knowing when I'll see them again or if I'll ever see them again. I've seen their frustration, their anxiety, their fear of the unknown when families lose the one thing that may be consistent, their childcare program. I've also seen them frustrated with their child losing their education, daily routine, and the security of knowing that their child is in a safe, nurturing, and loving environment while they're away at school or work. This is the stress our families face when losing child care assistance. And it for some of these families, and a lot of them, it happens every 6 months. For some, they have amazing stories, and I really wish you could hear them all, but they cannot be here today. Therefore, I'm asking that you support Senate Bill 1637, which changes the CCAP reauthorization period from 6 months to 12 months. This bill would help eliminate paperwork and wait time from caseworkers, which would help families keep authorization and not have to experience this distress every 6 months. This is a benefit for our families. This bill would provide more consistency for our children and families, thus building a better foundation for their success. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Olson. Are there others that wish to testify on the bill this time? There's no one. Are there questions from the members of the committee? Sarah Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Wicklin. On page 4, line 3, overpayment estimated to be less than $500 must not be established or collected. Where'd the $500 come from?
Sorry, Senator Benson, I'm just finding the place. Madam Chair, you're talking about the Senator Benson, the dollar figure that's included. How was that determined?
Yes.
I want to ask DHS. DHS was going to have.
Is someone from DHS here that can answer this
speak
question?
Speak to the choice.
Madam Chair, my name is Elizabeth Rowe. I'm manager of the Child Care Assistance Program at the Department of Human Services.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the $500 was included in the bill as a way to limit some situations in which overpayments might occur. This bill was also introduced last year. And one of the concerns that both the department and counties raised was the possibility of increased overpayments when we have a longer period of time between redeterminations and families possibly don't report changes. And when that happens, there is the possibility of overpayments. And so there are some provisions in this bill that would limit overpayments in some way and in some ways offset that potential increase.
Ms. Grohl, I think this language says that if the overpayment is estimated to be less than $500, it must not be collected. And what we're wondering is that related to the fact that the cost of trying to collect that exceeds what you're collecting here? There's a number here that's unclear as to why we wouldn't try to collect this $500.
Madam Chair, the overpayment language in this bill is also in the governor's budget bill, and there was work this summer with county stakeholders and providers looking at ways to simplify the child care assistance program and reducing situations in which overpayments would be established or collected was one of the strategies identified, particularly small overpayments, which have a significant level of work involved.
So it has to do with the amount of labor or effort that goes into collecting exceeds the $500, it sounds, from your Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what we're doing is increasing the likelihood of overpayment because we're not checking as often. We're reducing paperwork. That's a good thing. But then if there's an overpayment of $450, we're not going to do anything about it. I'm concerned that we're creating an environment where we can leave overpayments on the table. There's already a provision, paragraph 4 on that same page, where the county can't initiate proceedings if the overpayment exceeds, or if the cost to recover exceeds the amount of overpayment. So I want to think about this a little bit. The principle going forward is right. I'm just a little uncomfortable with how much we're leaving on the table. We're increasing the risk of overpayment, and we're doing less enforcement. I just want to see how much that's going to cost us.
Senator Hayden, it looked like you had a comment here.
Well, no, I think that Senator Benson's on the right track. I mean, it makes sense that you would, the cost to collect, I mean, I've done a couple of bills like that the cost to collect and to kind of try to chase down small amounts of money for low-income families that you may never, ever recover, that exceeds the amount that you're actually trying to get back. So, you know, I hope that there is some methodology about the $500. I think that's what Senator Benson was also asking. Is it just arbitrary? So I think what would be helpful in the next stop is to understand the methodology and maybe even a little run or some numbers that says how much this would cost in how much are we leaving on the table, but also how much does it cost you administratively to go after an overpayment? And I think that would help the committee understand how you arrived at $500, because I'm sure you did that work.
Any further questions or discussion from the committee on Senate File 1637? Senator Wicklin, your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move that Senate File 1637 be recommended to pass and be referred to Finance.
Finance. The motion is on the table. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion passes. I think Senator Wicklin, yours is the only voice I heard.
Yeah.
In that.
Oh, I see.
Did you? Okay. I could have spoken up louder myself. So let's do it again. It's the last bill with enthusiasm for the day. Last bill for the day. All those in favor in passing 1637 to Judiciary, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Finance. Oh, man, I'm sorry. To Finance, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Motion for adjournment, enthusiastically. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
Yeah.
Now in 15 minutes, I do state law.
Yeah. For 2.5 minutes.